This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
Well, this is not Drew Tignanelli tonight. It's Tom Bonvasuto, joined by the esteemed Christopher O'Shea.
Tom, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. It's great to be with you on the rare occasion that Drew isn't sitting across from this chair.
That's right. That's right. Well, and just to put everybody's mind at ease out there, Drew's fine. He's doing great. But he's being a great husband this week and taking care of his wife. Had a little procedure. Not little for her, probably, but she's doing great.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, we're glad he has that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, I know he's being a blessing to her this week. But tonight we have an interview and with an author of a really cool book.
Yeah,
I know that you and I have got a chance to look at it and read through it, and it's some really neat stuff. And so in a minute we're going to get to him. Now, I did want to just briefly, I don't know how we could do our show without briefly mentioning a little bit of what happened today in the world.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, so I mean, today we had a little bit of a delay, a little technical glitch on the New York Stock Exchange.
It's a big one for them.
Yeah, and and that caused some disruption in the market, and that all on top of, you know, China continuing to sell off pretty dramatically overnight. So we knew it was going to be a little bit of a rough day to start, and we continued to see the glitch. Now, that got resolved by the end of the day, and there will be questions that are unanswered at this time relative to why it happened and how could such a thing happen.
Sure.
But, you know, the markets ended, seemed to be relatively calm and orderly, if you will, because stocks were able to trade on other mm-hmm. exchanges. So I don't know if you saw anything else or heard anything else on the way. So,
nope.
So all is good. I know we had some trades that we were doing, and they all went off fine throughout the time that the market, the New York Stock Exchange was, halted.
Yeah.
So we were able to get it done in other markets and without impacting the price any more than it was already impacted from the China world news.
Right.
So, something just people might be wondering as they're driving around today, listen to the news.
Sure, as opposed to years gone past, what mm-hmm. would happen if the NYSE was down?
Right.
You know, you wouldn't have a whole lot else going on.
Yeah, yeah. So there's that, so this issue of kind of different markets being able to handle the same securities. It's not just, on the New York Stock Exchange or just on the NASDAQ. There's crossover trading that occurs in the different markets. So, but without further ado, let's see if we can get over to our author and Chris, you want to give a bio?
Sure. Yeah, I would love to. William Green has written for many publications in the U.S. and Europe, including a lot of these great publications, mm-hmm. Time, Fortune, Forbes, Fast Company, The New Yorker, The London Spectator, and The Economist. He edited the Asian edition of Time while living in Hong Kong, then moved to London to edit the European, Middle Eastern, and African editions of Time. As an editor and co-author, he has collaborated on books such as Guy Spier's much-praised memoir, The Education of a Value Investor, a theme which you'll hear more mm-hmm. as we talk tonight,
yeah.
and an upcoming autobiography of a legendary art collector. Born and raised in London, Green studied English literature at Oxford University and received a master's degree in journalism at Columbia University. He lives in New York with his wife, Lauren, and their two children, Henry and Madeline.
Yeah. So, William, are you out there?
I am. Hi, Tom. Hi, Chris. It's lovely to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. And now I know you're up in Westchester County, my old stomping grounds, but you're not from there.
That's right. I'm originally from London, but I moved here in my 20s, then moved to Hong Kong for a while, then back to London, and then back to New York about a year ago.
Okay, great. Well, as I said earlier, Chris and I had a chance to look at this book. First of all, it's a beautiful book. I would call it maybe more than a coffee table book, but it was definitely one of those things I can imagine, putting in our office in the lobby so people could read and so forth. It's really a nice book. But let me just kind of lay out things a little bit. We're going to chat a little here in the first segment. We've got till about 6:14, and then we're going to have three other segments. We'll ask you some questions about the book and kind of get a little bit of a history of how the project came about and some of the interesting things that you uncovered as you went through. So we'll go back and forth on that. And so the book is called The Great Minds of Investing, and it's really a combination of works by Michael O'Brien as the photographer, and then you, you know, writing and editing profiles of the different investors. Can you give us a little background on how the book came about?
Yeah, it came about because Michael O'Brien, actually in 1988, was sent to take a photograph of Warren Buffett by Esquire. And it kind of led to this this very long love affair with value investing that Michael has had. And over the years, he's taken portraits of everyone from Buffett and Munger to Bill Ackman, Jean-Marie Evehard, all of the great value investors, really. And so Michael had spent about 5 years working on this project, taking photographs of all these extraordinary people. And then last year suddenly said, you know, we need written profiles to go with the photographs that would add another dimension. Because the photographs kind of take you very, very up close to these people. So you're really engaged with them. You're looking someone like Buffett in the eye. You're looking Bill Miller in the eye, Bill Ackman in the eye. So you get this tremendous sense of their personality by looking at their face. But there's something about having written profiles that go with them as well that kind of adds another dimension. So Michael came to me and asked me to write the profiles, or in some cases edit profiles. And so there are 33 of them. And so it's an unusual project in that it gives you this kind of multi-dimensional look at these great investors. You know, you see something of their personality visually that I think you can't capture in words. And then at the same time, my job was to try to convey a bit of their story, their background, give a sense of who they are, what they believe, and how they became, you know, extraordinary investors, and what we can learn from them.
Yeah, that's great. It's a very cool book. Well, you know, when we come back in this next segment, I'd like to dive into some of the specific people in here that you found particularly interesting. And then there's actually somebody from Baltimore in your book, so I think that'll be interesting for the folks locally. So I'm going to turn it over, and we're going to take a traffic pause.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Well, it definitely felt like a hard day's night for the people at the New York Stock Exchange today, and a lot of people are going to be working into the night to figure out what happened there.
But, yeah, and someone's going to be answering for how does the stock exchange go down for 3.5 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're back with William Green, who's the author and has written profiles here of the great minds of investing. And William, why don't you tell us about some of your favorite investors here, or maybe some of the neat stories that you came across as you did this work.
Sure. In a way, maybe because we're talking about a very tumultuous time in the markets, it makes sense to talk about someone who lived through incredible amounts of tumult and turmoil, which is Irving Kahn, who was the oldest person in the book. He died a few months ago at the age of 109. And so a few months before he died, I was able to do what I believe is the last interview with Irving Kahn before he passed away. But it was a very strange interview because he was by then extremely sick and so couldn't meet me in person. And so what we ended up doing is his grandson, who works for his investment firm, basically agreed to take a handful of questions from me to his grandfather, who was, you know, at this point just about to turn 109. And so his grandson basically over a number of days asked his grandfather, who he adored, these questions and then came back to me with the answers. And so to me, the answers are kind of really, really moving and extraordinary, because this is a guy who started his investment career in 1929, just as the Great Depression and the crash of 29 began, then lived through World War II, lived through Vietnam. So really sort of saw everything, experienced multiple crashes. And so the first thing that I said that I asked his grandson to ask him was, you know, if there's a single piece of financial advice that you can share with us, what would it be? And what Irving Kahn came back with was, he said, safety. He said, considering the downside is the single most important thing an investor must do. And he was saying to me, you know, in our era, everyone does everything super fast, you know, and his image, he said, you know, you can gallop on a horse, but you know what direction it's going in. And he had studied actually with Ben Graham, who was the sort of father of all value investors. And he actually became Ben Graham's teaching assistant in the 1920s at Columbia University. And he said that what Graham had taught him above all else was that you really have to focus on how much you can lose before you focus at all on how much you can gain with anything. And so I thought that was really fascinating, this idea that, you know, instead of getting carried away as we tend to do when the markets are doing well by, you know, wow, I can get so incredibly rich. Here's this guy who's basically survived over, you know, what, 80 years as an investor by being incredibly conservative and just avoiding loss. And I think you see the same thing with people like Warren Buffett. You know, there's this famous quote from Buffett where, you know, he says that, you know, there are two rules for investing. The first rule is you know, don't lose, and the second rule is don't forget rule number one. And I think in times of tumult like this, you know, it's a really good reminder that, you know, you don't need to make incredibly heady, torrid returns to do really well over the long term. You know, you kind of need to you need to keep your wits about you, keep your ego under control, keep your emotions under control, be relatively calm, be patient, not take outrageous risk, and you know, leave what Ben Graham called a margin of safety, you know, which is this idea that, you know, you need to be quite conservative. You know, Buffett, I think, once explained it by saying, you know, that if you're building a bridge that has to take a 15,000 pound truck on it, you know, you want to build a bridge that can take 25,000 pounds. You know, there's always this idea that you want to build in a margin of safety so that, you know, whatever happens in the market, you'll be okay. And so I thought that was kind of profoundly important advice, and the fact that it came from a man of 109, sort of looking back on you know, basically an entire century of investing, gave the advice all the more credibility. So that's probably the first thing I'd like to share with the audience, really, since it's, you know, it's coming from you know, one of the giants of the last century of investing.
Well, sure, yeah. It just allows someone to put it in perspective, because as we see things, the longer we look at markets, the more we can put things in perspective. And so I just have to say, for everyone's thinking, okay, what his secret to living to 109? So I thought it was great that you included it in the book, and he said, I mean, you read it, it's got to be the genes, because he smoked for almost 40 years of his life, you know?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And he had, and he only ate red meat, pretty much.
Right.
You know, his son Thomas, who's in his 70s and who now runs the Kahn Brothers investment firm, said that you would take Irving, the grandfather, to a really fancy French restaurant. He'd just ask for, you know, a chop steak or a burger, you know, so he didn't exercise much. He smoked at least for about 40 years, but he was one of actually four siblings, all of whom lived to over 100, which is an astonishing thing. And he had a sister whose nickname was Happy, who lived to about 109, and one of the, maybe 110 if I remember rightly. And one of the things, so they were actually studied in all of these longevity studies. And one of the things that his son and his grandson, both of whom I interviewed, told me, they both said that what was key to Irving's longevity was the fact that he had this incredibly engaged mind. You know, he was incredibly inquisitive, and he was always just trying to learn. And I think that's one of the common characteristics with a lot of these great investors in this book is that, you know, they don't truly go into investing on the whole for the money. They go into it because they have incredibly curious minds, and investing gives them a way to sort of study the world, you know, to study companies, countries, industries. And so I think that's partly what kept Irving young for, you know, 109 years.
Sure, yeah, and the genes didn't hurt. One of the things that you mentioned in here about just being conservative, having safety, was I thought it was the contrast of the types of investors. There were some, many, maybe a little more than half of these folks believed in really concentrating. So although they were buying investments from a value perspective, and we're going to talk about Paul Tudor Jones at one point too, not the person you think of as a value guy, but that many of them were heavily concentrated in the things that they were buying. Some were not. Some went ahead and diversified and believe in diversification, but then even how you do a value investing differed.
Yeah, I think it's a really important idea. This whole concept of concentration versus diversification is really fascinating. And I think to some degree, you know, there are many ways to heaven, right? There isn't one right way to do it. What Marty Whitman once said to me is that diversification is a poor surrogate for knowledge. And so his view was, if you really know what you're doing, if you really understand a handful of companies, then it's okay not to diversify because, you know your 10 companies that make up 50% of your portfolio or 70% of your portfolio so well that it's actually not that risky to invest in a concentrated portfolio of stocks. But I think for the regular investor who you know, doesn't have that kind of knowledge, mm-hmm. concentration is a dangerous game. So I think part of it is figuring out, you know, what type of investor are you? You know, what's your temperament? What edge do you have? And so, you know, if you're Joel Greenblatt, say, who's one of the greatest value investors in the book, Greenblatt, you know, who's an extraordinary guy with an incredible mind, made returns of 40 or 50% a year for the first 20 years that he had a hedge fund, with most of his money in about 8 stocks at any given time. Now, you know, he was investing in very, very difficult to analyze situations, you know, spin-offs and all of these tiny companies that were very hard to analyze. And because he was analytically brilliant, he could do this. But he said to me, you know, every 3 or 4 months he'd suddenly have a nosedive where, you know, his portfolio would be down 30%. And so I think you have to know that you can take, you know, the increased volatility that's going to come with investing in a more concentrated way. And most people can't do that. And so one of the things that's fascinating about Greenblatt is that, you know, he sort of reinvented himself multiple times. And so now he runs a different kind of fund where he owns 300 stocks that he has long positions in and 300 that he has short positions in. So he's betting that they'll fall. And so it's a much more diversified approach. And he actually thinks the returns will be less good than he had with a concentrated portfolio. But he thinks his investors are going to be able to stomach the lower volatility. So, you know, part of the problem for investors is that we tend to blow ourselves up because we're mm-hmm. very emotional. So we sabotage ourselves. So if you can cope with the higher volatility that you have with a concentrated portfolio, great. But, you know, most people can't.
Yeah. Well, William, that's great insights, and you've just opened up a lot more questions for us. But we're going to take a pause for...
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right. Well, welcome back. This is Tom Bonvasuto with Chris O'Shea, and we're welcoming... back here, William Green on the Great Minds of Investing, a great book that I think should be in a lot of investment firms, but on a lot of coffee tables around town. It's a beautiful book. And, you know, one of the things, William, when I looked at the book and was reading through the book that kind of captured me, and maybe you could give us some insight into Michael, the photographer's thought processes. But first of all, the photos are very close up. And it's a lot of close-ups, and then everybody has a grim face.
Ha! Yeah, he doesn't like people to have these sort of fake smiles that we all adopt for, you know, our Facebook pages. You know, he's trying to capture the person's personality with a kind of intensity that and a sort of authenticity. And so he said to me that he actually doesn't talk during the time that he's photographing someone. He's very intensely focused. He'll take something like 250 frames of them. And he says his intensity and his engagement with them makes them very intensely engaged as well. And I think you see it in the photos. You know, when you look, say, in Charlie Munger's eyes, I mean, Charlie Munger now is about 90, right, 91, but he looks at you with this kind of intensity where you really see the intelligence in his eyes and the engagement. And I think the same thing with Buffett. You know, you look at him with a sort of immediacy that you can't get in any interview. You know, it's really like you're looking in his eyes. And I, I, I think that it's a remarkable thing about the portraits, that they have this kind of engagement with the person's character. So, you know, it kind of goes back to the phrase about, you know, the eyes being the window to the soul. With some of these guys, you know, you look at them and you know, it's kind of scarily intense. You don't just see Buffett as sort of an avuncular old man, you know, with like, you know, all of this down home wisdom from Omaha. You look at him as this, you know, ferociously intelligent guy. And so I find the photos really fascinating. You can kind of keep coming back at them and looking at them over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. They definitely capture you. And now, you know, prior to the break, we were talking a little bit about folks having these different philosophies and writing things through and being having convictions and the like. And, you know, even Jean-Marie Eviard, we interviewed him several years ago. And, you know, back in that heyday of the 90s, I mean, basically he was being questioned. And even the quote right here, the last sentence says, "How come I don't see it? There were days when I thought I was an idiot."
Huh.
Oh, you know, and I can't do the French accent very well, how he'd probably say that. But, you know, the point being is, you know, there's a lot of folks, and locally we've got a manager that you've profiled in here that would probably have the same sentiments and did to some degree in the book. Can you speak to our local investor here?
Yeah, you're obviously referring to Bill Miller, who's someone I've spent a tremendous amount of time with over the years, because I wrote a profile of Miller many years ago for Fortune, when he was sort of at the peak of his powers and fame and had beaten the market for something like 12 years running already. And so I think I spent something like 45 hours interviewing him back then. I flew on his private plane with him, and you know, he was kind of this god of the mutual fund world. And then, like a lot of these guys, you know, sort of hit the skids. And I think it's something we forget, is that in the course of a long life as an investor, you're going to get hit sometimes. You know, if you're someone like Peter Lynch, who I interviewed many years ago, and really Peter Lynch had a career that only lasted about 12 or 14 years.
Sure, right.
You know, you can come in and maybe you can get lucky and you can ride a really great period in the market. You can get out and everyone thinks you're a genius. But if you do this for 40 years, you're going to get hit at some point. And so in 2008, Miller kind of had this just horror show of a year where, you know, his smaller fund went down 65%. His bigger fund, like Mason Value Trust, went down, I think, 55%. And you know, suddenly he looked like a tremendous fool. And everything he had done in the past that was tremendously contrarian had worked out. And, you know, he had this amazing ability to go against the crowd and be right. And then he just went through this period where everything he touched kind of turned to dust. And this happens. And you know, we have a tendency to kind of idolize and lionize these people and make out that they're kind of the smartest people alive when they're doing well. And then we have a tendency to eviscerate them and make out that they're fools when they're doing badly. And the truth is that they're neither. You know, the markets are very, very difficult to play, because they change the whole time, and they're dynamic, and nobody can predict the markets, whatever they might claim. And so, you know, there are moments where you're going to come undone. And I think Miller, who I admire tremendously, has a great appetite for risk. You know, and he was probably more exposed than some of his fellow value investors. You know, he had less of a margin of safety than he might have done. But, you know, this is what had worked for him throughout his career. And so, you know, in a way he was true to himself. And you know, he's had a very impressive recovery in some ways.
Well, and that's what really struck me, was that despite his fund going down 90% from the peak to the trough, he hung in there, and although he lost control of the larger fund, he was still there with the Opportunity Trust, and now he's recovered, and the fund is gained some monies back, and his returns back. And that's the theme. Tom and I were talking off the air a little bit, is that the theme throughout the book also is, and the reason you're writing books about investors is this seems easy. You know, Tom and I have been in the business long enough that we've looked at, you know, value and other things, and you try to simplify investments. But in the end, a lot has to do with not being your own worst enemy, is that the emotions typically will get in the way of the not just the average person, but most investors. And most in these folks you're writing about have conquered that in some way. They've had a discipline in that area that they've exercised.
It's a very important point. The emotional aspect, the temperamental aspect of investing is absolutely key. And Miller said something to me that was really fascinating, which is that he said he actually thinks that if you put the greatest value investors in a laboratory and you did MRIs on them, you'd actually find that their brains are wired differently, so that they actually process fear and pain and the fear of loss in a different way to regular people. And I actually think that's an incredibly profound idea. You know, if you look at other people in the book, like Howard Marks, you know, I said to Howard Marks, you seem sort of really unemotional. And you know, he had bought $500 million worth of investments a week during the financial crisis when Lehman Brothers had imploded, and everyone was in a panic. And I said to him, did you find it hard? And he's like, no, not at all. And I said, you know, I knew that he'd been married a couple of times, and I said, has your lack of emotion been a problem with your marriages? And he's like, yeah, definitely with the first one, it was a real problem. He's like, I'm a bit better about it now. And I think there's an element with some of these guys that the greatest investors don't really feel emotion in the way that the rest of us do. A friend of mine who knows Buffett very well was saying that he actually thinks Buffett is inversely emotional, that he's not just unemotional, but at times when everyone else is panicking, he becomes kind of joyful and happy and more confident, you know. And I think it's a huge advantage for these people. And you know, one of the things, you know, the implication for the rest of us mere mortals is kind of important, right? Because you have to understand.
William, I'm going to have to give you a interrupt you there for a second for this traffic.
Sure.
And we'll be right back.
Last break of the night, and we'll be back.
Yep.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, well, welcome back. And we have with us tonight William Green, the great minds of investing. And it's been, time is flying. We've got about 9 minutes left in the show. And William, why don't you tell folks out there, you know, how do they get a hold of this beautiful book?
Thanks. Yeah, there are two main ways. One would be on Amazon.com, which I think is probably the simplest way. And then there's a website dedicated to the book itself, which is www.greatmindsofinvesting.com, which also has a few videos and a couple of excerpts and stuff. So you can get a flavor of the book there.
Great.
Sure. Okay, just we want to get back and ask you some of your favorites in here, but I did want to ask Paul Tudor Jones, how does he make it in your book on value investing?
That's a good question. I think they're really it's a very debatable and subjective thing. The whole process of listing great investors
is
always going to be subjective. It's always going to be incomplete. I think Jones is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
If I remember rightly, he came to fame because he made something like $100 million on a day, on a single day's trading,
right,
when he was about 30 or 31. So he's very remarkable. And what I felt, instead of kind of getting too hung up on, you know, should this guy be in, should this guy not, I sort of felt anyone who's in there, what can I learn from them? What's important to share? And I think he's someone who also has worked very, very hard to understand the role of emotion in investing. And so I think there are powerful lessons from him. And I was fascinated. There's another famous investor in there, Bill Nygren, who said to me that one of the things he does is he actually studies investors who are totally the opposite from him. Hmm. So he studies Michael Steinhardt, who was a famous hedge fund manager, not in the book,
right,
who would sort of turn over his entire portfolio in 2 weeks sometimes.
Sure.
And he said, you know, it's really important to study people who are totally different from you as investors, because it kind of gives you a way to stress test your own approach. So I think there's a benefit to the fact that you have all these different guys in the book who sort of give you a sense that there's no single way to heaven. You know, there are a lot of ways to be a really good investor, and you know, I think at its heart, what you want to do is is buy the most amount of assets for the least amount of money. But there are a lot of different ways to interpret that. You know, and Buffett himself changed over the course of his career. You know, he started out buying cheap stocks, and in the end, he bought, you know, better companies. So there's a benefit to being flexible and not sort of religious or dogmatic in our definition of what the best way is to invest.
Oh, sure. No, Paul Dooner Jones is someone that we read about, I think, years ago, I guess, initially when Schwager wrote about him, Market Wizards. He is a great investor, and really you can learn from folks like that. Looking at the different personalities in here, we see most of these folks, for as much money as they've made, they're a pretty humble lot of folks, and not many of them take outsized opinions of other things. Though there are occasionally, I want to get to Marty Whitman because he takes a real stab at Jack Bogle. But all these folks have in common, though, is they don't think much of efficient market, theory and recent things like that. The indexing, which has taken the U.S. by storm and other places. Marty Whitman says he's an idiot.
Whitman is wonderfully candid. So yeah, he talks about Bogle, who's sort of the patron saint of indexing, and says, Bogle's an idiot. But
for the folks who are listening out there, so Bogle's built a firm that has $3 trillion in assets at Vanguard. Yeah. But mm-hmm. but sure.
You know, I think there's a kind of profound truth there, right? We all know indexing is a very, very powerful approach and that it's very difficult to beat the market over the long term. But we also know that there's a tiny minority of investors who do beat the market over the long term. And
right.
so what I think is fascinating for all of us and really helpful is to figure out what have these guys done that I can replicate, that I can copy. That to me is the most interesting question. It's how do you look at a guy like Buffett and say, all right, what do I mirror that he does? And one of the most fascinating guys for me in the book was Monish Pabrai, who said to me, that he started a 30-year game to turn $1 million into $1 billion by compounding at 26% returns annually. And he said he's never had an original idea in his life. All he's done is basically try to reverse engineer Buffett. And he said, it's incredible that you have this guy who's basically laid out the rules of investing, like the laws of the universe. And we live in a world where everyone ignores what he actually does, that, they kind of fail to put into play the kind of lessons that have made Buffett one of the richest guys in the world. So I think that was one of my purposes in writing the book, was to figure out, how do you take these extraordinary minds and mm-hmm. then take, one, two, three lessons from each of their lives and say, all right, so I can apply that to my life and I'll be, this much better an investor. And I think if we don't do that, you kind of don't stand a chance of beating the market. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. And so, when you look at these guys, you learn about the importance, say, of not trading, of being patient, of not trying to predict the market, not trying to go in and out of the market fast. Being a very patient long-term investor and being focused on avoiding fads and things like that. And so I think there are a lot of very powerful truths that if you want to be a good, successful long-term investor, you'd be foolish to ignore. And I think these guys embody a lot of them.
Do you think, William, that in this day and age with the Internet and the speed in which things are traveling and news and the ability to trade faster, that these folks would be as successful or, is the market irrational longer than they could remain solvent?
It's a fascinating question. I think all of us are being bombarded with information. And you feel sometimes that it's empowering and that it helps you, but I think for most of us, actually, it kind of messes with us. And because we're very emotional creatures and we're sort of irrational and we have these crazy brains that sabotage us as investors, we don't quite know how to handle this kind of cascade, this torrent of information coming at us. And so Pat Dorsey, one of the guys I interviewed, said to me that he thinks the single most important thing for an investor is not to have a Bloomberg terminal in their study, in their office, and not to have a TV in their office. And his point, I think, is really relevant to all of us. It's that you kind of want to detach yourself from the market. You know, you don't want to be ruled by the market and looking at, you know, when you read a story and it says, wow, Chinese stocks were down 6.9% today, you know, you get a little dopamine rush and it makes you a little irrational and a little crazy and fearful. And I think what a lot of these great investors do is they take a much longer term perspective. And so they say, all right, so I'm going to buy some undervalued stocks and I'm going to stick with them for a long time and I'm not going to trade in and out. And I think for most of us, actually detaching yourself from this enormous amount of high speed information is a very helpful thing. I try personally just not really to read about the stock market that much. You know, I placed my bets and I'm detaching and I know that I'm too emotional. And so I'm kind of trying to take myself out of the equation. And so I think it's very important for you as an investor to know yourself, you know, to figure out this is how I work, right? And so I know I'm going to panic when the market's tumbling, so I want to take myself out of the equation. So I'm going to outsource it to a money manager who's got a better temperament than me. Or, you know, you have to really understand yourself so that you can see how you're going to react in these tumultuous times. Because otherwise, you're just subject to these sort of this buffeting that happens constantly from all this sort of short-term information that's coming at you from your TV and your computer.
Yep. Yeah. Well, William, it's amazing how quickly the time will fly, and you've written a great book here. It's we have William Green, The Great Minds of Investing, and I think it's a book that our listeners would really appreciate if they got a chance to read it. And
sure, if people are just coming in,
yep.
William says you can get it online at Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. You can also look at greatmindsoninvesting.com, but certainly it's worth it looking at these folks if you're interested in just knowing more about investing.
Yeah.
So William, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for being with us tonight.
And it's been a real pleasure.
All right.
And pleasure's ours, yes.
Yeah, that's great. And so this is Tom Bombasuto and Chris O'Shea, and next week, look forward to having Drew Tignanelli back in the driver's seat.
Man, we'll be back in the chair. Have a great week.
That's right. God bless everyone.